dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence is highly prized by, well, me for sure, and by, I think, all of our listeners, and many more besides, is Gordon Chang. We have the privilege of speaking with him each week about this time, and it could hardly be a more important moment to take stock with him what's going on than as we see a third American carrier battle group heading towards the Korean Peninsula, joining two others already in place there and causing many, including our friend Gordon, to suggest this is a big deal and potentially a prelude to military operations against the North. Gordon Chang, welcome back, sir. It's good to have you with us.
And it's good to be on your show, Frank. So thank you so much.
Tell me a little bit about your thoughts on this deployment and why it seems so momentous.
There are already two carrier strike groups near Korea, the one centered around the Carl Vinson and the Ronald Reagan. Later this week, the Nimitz group will be leaving its base in Bremerton and going to the Western Pacific. And that means unprecedented three carrier groups, three large decks in the Western Pacific. This certainly is a message to the North Koreans, but they don't seem to be getting it because they're firing off ballistic missiles at the pace of about one a week. And so this sets up a confrontation, a test of wills between Kim Jong-un and President Trump. And if we do nothing in this case, then the North Koreans will take the measure of the new American leader and say that they will be emboldened to do even more provocative and belligerent things. So I think the president has, our president needs at this point to understand the consequences of actually, and the symbolism of bringing three large decks into the Western Pacific and hopefully being able to stop the North Koreans.
Gordon, you have also suggested that the testing of their own nuclear deterrent forces, involving a sixth test specifically, may be in the offing as well. Would that, in your judgment, translate into a catalyst for a conflict between the United States and the North?
Well, that could very well be the case. There is reporting from the Japanese that Chinese President Xi Jinping actually put the hard word on the North Koreans to not conduct their sixth test. And this was after Xi sat down with Donald Trump, of course, at Mar-a-Lago in early April. And so if the North Koreans go forward with something which is especially belligerent, we can assume a couple things, that either the Chinese wanted them to do it or were unable to do that. But in any event, it means that we've got to solve this on our own. Now, there are a lot of things that we can do short of kinetic action to stop the North Koreans, but they involve political will. So, for instance, they involve secondary sanctions on Chinese entities and banks that have been participating in illicit relations with the North Koreans. We have not been willing to do that, and that's not just a question of the Obama administration failing. It's also we've known these things for a long time. And indeed, we can say the Bush administration's policy towards North Korea have, in their own ways, been misguided, different than the mistakes in the Obama administration, but nonetheless mistakes. And so we've got to think about how we're going to deal with the North Koreans, exercise some political will, because if we don't exercise that political will, Frank, we will get involved in a war. And this war may not just be the U.S. versus North Korea. It could be China and North Korea versus the United States. So we're talking about consequences that we are not prepared at this point to think about, not our policymakers and indeed not even our military.
This brings us, of course, very directly to the question of what role China is playing. Gordon, you've written that it has been making empty promises to rein in North Korea. If the Chinese are still just going through the motions, what does that suggest is likely to be their role in the event there is, in fact, a conflict with North Korea and the United States?
Yeah, we don't know the answer to that question, Frank. We didn't know it in 1950 when General Douglas MacArthur, who was in command of U.S. forces in Korea and U.N. forces in Korea, did not think that the Chinese would intervene when he pushed the North Koreans back up toward the Yalu River. And we know that they did. Now we sort of assume that they wouldn't intervene if there were a conflict with North Korea. But I'm not so sure what the calculus in Beijing would be in this case, especially with a very arrogant, very provocative Xi Jinping, who believes that the United States is in terminal decline and that he can basically do what he wants.
And you've also described in previous conversations, Gordon Chang, the degree to which the Chinese military is kind of spoiling for a fight and may be given its head, it would appear, by Xi, as we'll be talking about shortly with Rick Fisher. He's very much engaged now, apparently, in this Chinese buildup and all that that may portend in terms of power projection capabilities.
Yes, well, I'm concerned about the buildup, of course, but what I'm concerned about is what the Chinese are in fact doing at this particular moment. And we know that they challenged a U.S. Air Force WC-135, which is Constant Phoenix, the sniffer plane, the one that looks for radioactivity. And essentially what the Chinese were saying is that the United States should not be looking for radioactivity in the case of a possible North Korean test. So this, I think, more than anything what Xi Jinping might say, is actually his intention toward the United States. And indeed, after that dangerous intercept of the WC-135, there was an intercept of a U.S. Navy P-3C Orion just south of Hong Kong in international airspace again. So this is a very dangerous situation where we think the Chinese are on our side. I don't think that they are, and we have to be alive to the possibility that we may actually end up in a conflict with them.
One of the things that we'll be talking about momentarily with Kevin Freeman, Gordon, is the evidence that the Chinese are responding to a downgrade in their bond ratings by the American company Moody's. As though this is some sort of act of economic warfare against them. Again, this may play into a dynamic that you're concerned about, as I think we all should be. Talk about that, if you would.
Yeah, Moody's downgraded China one notch. They're still investment grade. And China has been belligerent in its response. And actually, I think we should be concerned about how the Chinese have responded, not only because of what Kevin says, but also because the explanations that China has that they're reforming just aren't true. And so I think China is moving, maybe inching, maybe moving quite fast toward a systemic debt crisis.
Gordon, to the extent that China is moving in that direction, and again, we are looking at the possibilities of these external forces being used to justify domestic repression and continued control by the Communist Party, all of this seems to me to be, you know, evidence of a further movement, inexorable perhaps, but dramatic, in the direction of hostilities between the United States, perhaps with the Chinese proxy, North Korea, but also quite possibly with the Chinese themselves. Do you think it's overstating the case?
Not overstating the case at all. You know, Secretary Mattis said that if there were a war on the Korean Peninsula, it would be tragic on an unbelievable scale. And that sort of persuades people that it won't happen. Yet it could very well happen. And indeed, the United States has been taken by surprise so many times. You know, it's 9/11. It's December 7th. We don't understand the nature of our adversaries and what they intend. And that's our fault. And we need to understand what the Chinese are doing. They're proliferating ballistic missile technology to the North Koreans in all probability. We know, in fact, they're selling equipment for North Korea's ballistic missile program. And we're not asking the Chinese questions. And so, you know, this is a failure of the American political system, American policymakers, to understand the nature of the challenge. And despite all of this, Frank, China just got an invitation to participate in RIMPAC 2018. I can't understand this at all.
I hope on the basis of this kind of information, as you say, policymakers will understand better and be able to deal more correctly with the threats that we're facing. In the meantime, thank you for the terrific work you do at The Daily Beast, World Affairs Journal, and at Forbes.com, as well as, of course, Fox News and with us. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us again next week.
Visit us at Facebook.com/SecureFreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say, joined as, again, we have the privilege of being each week by Kevin Freeman, our duty expert on matters involving economic warfare. In fact, this is an area of specialization that has prompted him to found globaleconomicwarfare.com. It is also the subject of his two best-selling books, Game Plan, How to Protect Yourself from the Coming Cyber Economic Attack, and his first, Secret Weapon, How Economic Terrorism Brought Down the U.S. Stock Market and Why It Can Happen Again. Kevin is a senior fellow, I'm pleased to say, at the Center for Security Policy and the host of the upcoming television program on the Blaze Network, Economic War Room, with Kevin Freeman. Kevin, so good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Thank you, Frank. Good to be here.
Well, I wanted to pick up on something I discussed a moment ago with Gordon Chang, just to get your read on it. There is now, among other places in the Russian press, Sputnik specifically, reporting that what happened when the American company Moody's downgraded modestly some of the Chinese bonds, that there was really an act of economic warfare by the United States against China. What's your response to that?
Well, first off, you know, bonds get downgraded all the time. The U.S. Treasury bond was downgraded, so you know, I don't believe that this was in any way an act of economic warfare, but it's being interpreted that way, and that's not new. We've talked before about the book Unrestricted Warfare, written in 1999 by two senior colonels of the People's Liberation Army, and you open it up, and it talks about downgrade by Moody's, Standard & Poor's, Morgan Stanley of credit ratings, you know, is a weapon, and they talk about those being instruments of U.S. government policy and that they're purposed and directed at the Asian nations, and they were discussing the currency crisis that happened in the late 1990s. But if that was the attitude, then it's likely that it's being perceived in the same way today.
Kevin, if in fact the Chinese choose to retaliate against this perceived act of economic warfare, let me ask you, would you expect that that may take the form of indirect action, supporting rather than constraining their North Korean proxies? Might it be new assaults on our currency, something they've been, again, putting themselves in position to engage in for some time, specifically through manipulation or by, I guess, the act of supplanting us as the world's reserve currency, the dollar, that is? Or might it take the form of more direct action against, for example, freedom of navigation operations near their seized and manufactured and now fortified islands?
You know, that's the point of the doctrine of unrestricted warfare, is it could take any of those forms or a combination of those forms, which is the preferred method. We already know that the Chinese have tied North Korea and our economic relationship with China together. We saw that the president has also said, hey, why would we call them a currency manipulator when they're helping us with North Korea? So these two have intimately been tied together. So, of course, they might look at any means of changing the relationship regarding North Korea as a means of pressuring us or responding to this Moody's downgrade. The currency, they've already declared we must de-Americanize the world. Why should America, from their perspective, they say, why should America run the global economic system? And this Moody's thing is just one more thing. They say, look, it's an American ratings agency. Well, it's American because we've pretty much built the global financial system. They don't like it. They want to create an alternative to it, and that means attacking or displacing the U.S. dollar when the time is right for them. So it could be any of these things or a combination of these things.
Well, this is, needless to say, something that we'll be following very closely here at Secure Freedom Radio, Kevin, as there seems now increasingly to be a prospect that things may go from sort of ersatz warfare to unrestricted warfare, including of the violent kind in the South China Sea and beyond. But let me switch gears on you if I can, Kevin. You've been tracking and trying to make sense of the Bitcoin phenomenon. There's a number of different stories regarding this new form of cryptocurrency, I guess you might call it. Let's start with the fact that this currency has just lost $4 billion in value. How did that happen, and what does it portend for the future viability of this this technique, sort of disguising who's using the currency and for what purposes?
Well, let's start with the idea that Bitcoin is really a creative potential internet-based way of keeping track of who owns what money. It's built on the blockchain. The idea is that you can pass it anonymously. It is universal. It covers the whole world. It goes through the internet. It can't be stolen easily. It's highly encrypted. It's protected. It's not subject to governments promoting it so that you run wild in the amount of currency that's put out there. So it's got a lot of positive attributes. But it also has some serious flaws. One of the flaws is that it's extraordinarily volatile. No good currency is volatile, that one day it's worth $2,700 per Bitcoin in U.S. dollars, and the next day it's worth $2,200. That's not a good stable currency. It's not something you can transact global business on, at least not yet. We saw the pricing drop, as you mentioned, $4 billion, which is about a 20% plunge. But if you put $100 in Bitcoin back 7-8 years ago, it's worth measured in the tens of millions of dollars today in translation. So really what it is a speculation using very interesting technology. Now, Australia just recently declared that they would accept Bitcoin as currency, and you could spend it without having to pay a capital gain or being able to take a capital loss if it changed in value against the local currency. That's a big step forward. I see someday we may have a global monetary system that's built around this kind of technology. Right now we're seeing a lot of speculation in it, and it is being touted, and it may have run up in price because the Chinese people are afraid of the local economy, of the yuan and the potential there, and so they don't want to put it in dollars, or maybe they're not allowed to, so they've gone onto these internet sites and they've purchased Bitcoin, and that's a means of getting money out of the country. Right now, you know, maybe $40 billion total outstanding of Bitcoin, but someday it could be very huge.
Let me just ask you one other issue that has arisen, Kevin Freeman, in connection with Bitcoin's use, is that by terrorists. Tell us about that and what the implications might be for all of us if it's continuing.
Well, it's ideal for terrorists and drug dealers because, you know, the transactions that you have to be anonymous. And so historically, transactions have been done with paper money. But it gets really bulky when you're moving millions of dollars around to move paper money. And so you see these drug cartels where they'll seize mountains of cash. And bin Laden was supposedly found with a 500 euro note, I think it was, pinned inside of his jacket. That's what you have to trade in as currency. You can't use your local Visa or MasterCard. It's too easily traced. But Bitcoin allows people to move large sums of money very anonymously. You don't see who's sending it. You don't see who's receiving it. It's not easy to track. And so it is something that is being adopted by terrorists, and it's a reason that governments would like to crack down on the use of Bitcoin, or create their own alternative where they can actually see behind the curtain and know who's transacting the business. And I think that's probably where governments of the world will head. So the anonymity goes away, but some of the other features remain present.
We'll look forward to more of your reporting on this really interesting and very, very dynamic subject at globaleconomicwarfare.com and in the forthcoming Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. Kevin, thanks for your time today. Keep up the great work, my friend, for all of us.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Richard Fisher. He is the senior fellow on the Asian Military Affairs beat at the International Assessment and Strategy Center. He is also president of Pacific Strategies, Inc. He has written widely and is highly regarded for his expertise with respect to matters involving China's military, specifically the subject of his recent book, China's Military Modernization, Building for Regional and Global Reach. Rick, it's good to have you back. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Frank.
I saw a piece over the weekend, Rick, about how the Chinese have unveiled at their latest arms show two different radar systems they claim are going to be capable of defeating, or at least helping them track and thereby defeat, advanced stealth aircraft of the kind we have spent many, many tens of billions of dollars developing and deploying. How serious a threat do you believe this represents to our aircraft and the personnel manning them?
Frank, both the Chinese and the Russians have invested heavily over the last 25 years in a range of counter-stealth technologies. The Chinese are not just investing in the kind of radar that you saw described, which are really at the high end, meaning they are directed beam, active, electronically scanned, phased array systems that are very complex and expensive. Take this cutting-edge beam technology and marry it to advanced, powerful computing, and therefore are much more capable of finding stealth aircraft. The Chinese and the Russians are also investing in passive radar technologies, which use multiple, or in the Chinese case, even a single receiver, if you will, to gather an ocean of signals and then process those signals in order to find the stealth aircraft. Passive radar technology has been around for a long time, and the Chinese have purchased a pioneering passive radar system from the Ukraine and have since copied it. But this is a big deal and puts a lot of pressure on the Americans to improve our stealth technologies, and also puts a premium on staying ahead in terms of electronic warfare systems, jamming systems that must also help us at the right time in a combat mission to get the greatest benefit out of our stealth investment.
Rick, you've put your finger on something that I've heard about but don't know quite what to make of, and that is very substantial improvements in Chinese computational capabilities to the extent that some have suggested that they may be surpassing our own supercomputing capabilities. Does that sound right to you? And if not at the moment, is that what is in prospect?
Well, the Chinese have been engaging in a long-standing computer power race with the United States. And in terms of supercomputers based on current technologies, the Chinese have the current bragging rights, but there are also reports about an American supercomputer that may emerge imminently that may vastly exceed the capability of the most powerful Chinese computer. But let's not forget that we're also both developing quantum computing technologies, which offer capabilities unimaginable compared to what we are able to field today. And these systems are being weaponized by the Chinese almost as soon as they're able to develop them.
Rick, you've been writing a lot of late about some of the future capabilities that the Chinese are bringing to bear. Give us a flavor of a couple of them. Specifically, you've indicated there are reports that there may be a semi-submersible arsenal ship. What would that be, and what would its value be to the Chinese?
Well, yes, Frank. Over the last several days, there has been a minor storm on Chinese military web pages about the likelihood that China has decided to start construction of a new class of semi-submersible arsenal ship. Back in the 70s, the United States came up with ideas of arsenal ships, or basically ships stuffed with missiles, to complement our aircraft carrier battle groups. The American side dropped the idea way back then, but it appears that it may be possible China has picked up on the idea, and it's a good one given the great advances that have taken place in missiles and in making them accurate, and also marrying such ships with advanced defensive weapons like railguns, which both the Chinese and the United States are working on.
Why semi-submersible rather than completely submersible, Rick?
Well, being fully submersible entails a greater expense. You become a submarine, whereas semi-submersible allows you to stay just below the surface. It's far more difficult to find you, and yes, it is a basic, affordable enhancement in survivability.
Speaking of affordable enhancements, the Chinese seemingly have begun in a very systematic way to arm the islands that they have manufactured across the South China Sea. Rick, give us a sense of how formidable those defenses are now. And when you have an American warship demonstrating freedom of navigation rights in immediate proximity to one of them, in the Spratlys, I believe. What do you think are the prospects that this is going to lead to blows?
The Chinese are going to be arming these islands to the hilt. They will have, the ones with airfields will have a large number of combat aircraft, patrol aircraft, anti-submarine aircraft, AWACS, the whole kit and caboodle, and they will also be armed with anti-aircraft missiles, which are achieving ever greater range, and also anti-ship missiles, which are already pretty long range from the Chinese.
And to the extent that they're building in a considerable capacity to not only defend those islands, but to project power from them, do you anticipate this is going to lead to a conflict, Rick?
Well, just 2 weeks ago, Xi Jinping threatened to go to war against the Philippines, telling this to the Philippine president right to his face if the Philippines started drilling for oil in disputed water. The buildup on the Spratly Islands in the South China Sea will likely enable China to very quickly mount punitive raids, if not occupy the Philippine island of Palawan. Building up defenses against a Chinese invasion as surreal as it seems, is now a top priority for the Philippines, although it doesn't appear that the current president is focused on this at all.
You mentioned Xi Jinping, the president of China, and it's reported by Bloomberg that he is taking a personal role in the buildup and creating new options for China, not seen since the days of Deng Xiaoping. Is that your reading as well, Rick?
Yes, he is in smack in the middle of one of the most profound reorganizations of the People's Liberation Army since the 1950s. He is more or less completing a process started under Deng Xiaoping to rearm China. And what Xi is doing is configuring the PLA to be able to conduct surprise joint force military operations anywhere on its periphery, while at the same time building up China's capacity for global power projection.
You've been writing on this brilliantly. It's great to have a chance to visit with you about your analyses. Check them out, by the way, at Jane's Defense Week. Also, at the International Assessment and Strategy Center, where Rick Fisher is a senior fellow. Rick, it's good to talk with you. Keep up the good work and come back to us again, if you would, very soon. Next up, we'll speak with Russ Dallin about the latest Goldman Sachs bailing out Venezuela's Maduro.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're joined by Russ Dallin, one of our duty experts on things in the hemisphere, a beat he's very familiar with as the president and editor-in-chief of the Latin American Herald Tribune. He is formerly the president of Venezuela's 60-year-old newspaper, The Daily Journal, and he has been active in the business side of the hemisphere as well through his investment bank, Caracas Capital Markets. Russ, it's so good to have you back. Thank you very much for taking a few minutes with us.
Thank you, Secretary. It's always a pleasure, sir.
We have a news story here that is important on several different respects, it seems to me. One is what Goldman Sachs, company with which you're very familiar, of course, from your work in the investment business, has been doing in Venezuela of late. I'd like to talk to you about both the immediate transaction and its implications, Russ.
Absolutely, and it created a stir. It's on the front page of the Wall Street Journal this morning, as a matter of fact. But basically, Venezuela has been sort of isolated from the financial markets. While its existing debt does trade, it trades at pennies on the dollar, 40 cents, 50 cents, basically precluding them from accessing new capital, like any company. When its bonds or stocks are out there in the market, you buy a share of IBM. IBM doesn't get any money. It's the guy who sold it to you because IBM's already been paid from the IPO. Venezuelan debt has been the same. But they had some debt that they hadn't been able to sell that they did in 2014, and it's been in the central bank. Well, over the last week, $800 million came into Venezuela's coffers, and we couldn't figure out where it came from until the Wall Street Journal broke the story that it came from Goldman Sachs, who bought $2.8 billion of Venezuelan debt at $865 million. In Goldman Sachs' defense, they've said it was from a broker, but the money went straight to Venezuela. The broker was a small intermediary who was probably responsible for extracting a nice commission to pay the people involved, but basically giving lifeblood to a dictatorship who's crushing and killing and maiming its own people to try and stay in power in Venezuela.
Let me ask you, what are the benefits to PDVSA of this deal and to Goldman?
Well, the benefit to PDVSA is nothing. This was bonds that they issued and gave to the central bank to pay an IOU to the Venezuelan central bank, who they'd sucked money out of. So they essentially get nothing out of this. The Maduro government, however, does get $865 million that it didn't have last week. The benefit to Goldman Sachs is, of course, that they'll earn four times their money if and when this is ever paid. In 2022, when these bonds come due, they'll have made over four times their $865 million.
But in the process, as you say, they have done a huge disservice to the people of Venezuela and a great benefit, sort of new life support for this odious regime that is oppressing them. What does Goldman Sachs say about the strategic implications of this, or are they indifferent to them?
No, they released a statement late last night because of the furor. Actually, there are protests at their headquarters in New York today at 12:30. There are some coming in Miami on Thursday. People are up in arms about this transaction. It was a huge faux pas from a reputation point of view for Goldman Sachs to do this. And they have basically admitted that they did it, but they said that they believed in the future of Venezuela, and that's why they did it.
Yes. It just may be harder to get to the future with them having done it. The opposition is among those up in arms, as I understand it, in Venezuela as well. Is that right?
That's correct. I mean, it's 80% of the population wants to get rid of this guy, but he's not going. He's blocked elections. And now they're trying to change the constitution so there's not one man, one vote elections, because they couldn't win that. They're going to have the same thing that they do in Cuba and in the Soviet Union. They're going to have collectives basically nominate who can be on, who can run for power.
This is really a tragedy of the first order. I wonder, as there are a number of prominent alumni of Goldman Sachs in the Trump administration, I'm thinking of Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, Gary Cohn, the Director of the National Economic Council, and Dina Habib-Powell, the Deputy National Security Advisor, for starters. Do you think that there's a sympathy for this kind of behavior on Goldman Sachs's part for the Trump administration's, at least some of its senior leadership?
Gosh, I hope not. There's no defense. I mean, we expect hedge funds to behave like this because they're amoral sharks, and that's what they do. But this is Goldman Sachs. It's one of the leading international firms in the world, which took, by the way, U.S. taxpayer bailout money in 2008, 2009, because of the economic crisis and its role in the subprime lending, which, frankly, we should know that you would expect that it would learn from that, because basically not only did they take taxpayer bailout money, but they had a role in structuring securities which were designed to fail based on subprime lending, which were designed to blow up and screw their own customers. The second problem that they had was a few years ago when Greece went bankrupt, was that they had been helping Greece to hide some of its deficit spending and its debt through financial maneuvers that kept the European Union from knowing just how bad the situation and the debt situation in Greece was. You would think that that kind of reputational risk, they would learn from it. But as this week's actions show, that they haven't.
It does seem to me that with these senior executives now in senior positions in the U.S. government, there's a special burden on both the company and on these alumni to begin mending their ways.
It is outrageous. And Marco Rubio has actually, he's tweeted about it, saying he was shocked that Goldman would be involved in doing this. So it has come to the, you know, to the attention of one of the leading senators who's been, you know, fighting for Venezuela.
Hey, let me quickly turn to one other topic that we've been tracking with you, Russ. Give us an update, if you can, on what's going on with this effort by the Russians to take over some of Citgo's assets in the United States with potentially very, very ominous implications for our energy security interests.
Yes. So, you know, your listeners will recall, we discovered Venezuela had mortgaged half of its Citgo refineries in the United States to Russia back in November for $1.5 billion. And we went to Congress and asked for a CFIUS review for the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, which is responsible for looking at all of these things, to take a look at this transaction, because it wasn't kosher in the sense of having the Russians own half of the sixth largest refinery in the United States, which provides 19% of the gasoline market. And suddenly that the Russians were going to be in control of that. At any rate, the House and then the Senate wrote to Secretary Mnuchin, a Goldman Sachs alum, by the way, as you noted, to ask for CFIUS review of this transaction, because they were quite concerned about Russian ownership of important United States infrastructure, energy infrastructure. And they got no response until Secretary Mnuchin, in his first testimony as Secretary of the Treasury and head of CFIUS before the Senate, was cross-examined by Senator Robert Menendez of New Jersey, who specifically asked him about the Russian transaction with Venezuela over Citgo. And Secretary Mnuchin promised that they were looking at it and they would be having future discussions about it with him, both classified and in an open setting.
Keep up the good work, my friend, at the Latin American Herald Tribune. We appreciate your time and your expertise tremendously. Come back to us again very soon.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.